Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the August 30th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the August 30th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. I'm your host, Bob Curie. It's Sunday, August 30th, on a nice, quiet afternoon. And we're going to do a little show today about the state of the stock market and also touch on a couple of other political topics. The chat is open if you wish to participate in the chat and to call into the show. The phone number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. This is another one of the Sunday afternoon shows. I've decided that this time slot, usually it's going to be either 1 or 2 o'clock Eastern time on a Sunday, kind of fits my ability to produce the show better than the evening slots are. But we're still going to do evening shows when circumstances warrant, and especially during for each night of the political debates, and I'll be sending out more information on that as we get closer to the next debate day, which is September 16th. But this show is going to concentrate for a while on the state of the stock market and all of the volatility therein, and just make some observations on what's driving the market, things to look for, things that are getting some emphasis in the news, things that individual investors should be aware of as they try to make sense out of what's happening. And then we'll go into a couple of the political topics and then wrap it up. It'll be a short show, about 60 minutes, and so let's get underway. Well, the markets had quite a wild ride in the month of August. Late last week, not the week just passed, but the week prior to that, they started to take a tumble, and they moved down over 11% from where they were at the beginning of the month. And there were 3 days of very frenzied trading, light volume, but very distinct downward direction in prices. And then there was a little rebound triggered by a good GDP report and some encouraging news that the situation in China might be stabilizing. But why is the market so nervous? There are a lot of unusual things going on, and when there are unusual things, that is going to feed into volatility and nervousness. One of them is oil, oil prices being at a kind of cyclical low for the 6.5-year low. Obviously, that is a good thing for consumers, but there is a negative spillover into oil stocks and also into employment in the oil sector industry, and it spills over into other sectors. I mean, if you're a financial institution and you're lending, you're known to be lending to oil and gas exploration, your investors are going to get worried about you. If you're if you make oil exploration and drilling equipment, or you're in oil exploration services, there's going to be spillover into your sector as well. So the trade-off is how long does it take to get lower consumer prices spent and stimulate other sectors of the economy to offset the immediate hit in the oil sector and related sectors. And no one knows the answer to that question, so the markets get very nervous and they trade downwards. We also have the kind of volatility in the currency market. The U.S. dollar had been rising already throughout much of the year in response to expectations of higher interest rates, and the large capitalization stocks, the multinationals that are popular with investors because they seem to be a relatively safe bet in Obama's slow growth and highly regulated economy, those multinationals have been taking foreign exchange earning hits, and that is a theme in their earnings reports and analyst calls. So multinationals like IBM, Coca-Cola, Apple, they are looked at with some concern by investors who see that a good part of their earnings are derived from overseas in depreciating currency. Of course, the elephant in the living room is China. It's got a very strange economic setup where you have this rigidly authoritarian government structure kind of sitting on top of a market economy, which is very dynamic, but there is also this state-controlled sector, which is a drag on Chinese productivity and growth. China had encouraged a stock market bubble last year by liberalizing all kinds of stock market regulations, and then retail investors in China looking to find a place to park their money moved into it into a big way. And so a bubble happened. A lot of people were buying in at the top. China became very concerned about a market bubble. Then they took some efforts to deflate it. Naturally, there was overreaction. Chinese equity prices crashed. And now you have a situation where many Chinese investors have losses in their portfolio, and there is a concern that that will cut into China consumer spending, that it will slow down growth. And China's export sector has also been kind of slowing down. So a lot of worries about China. China does not have a real market economy, and it's important to understand that. Like I said before, they have a huge state sector. The government intervenes everywhere. They have a big real estate and infrastructure bubble, similar to but probably worse than what went on in the U.S. housing market during our bubble in the last decade, where there is a lot of spending on new real estate projects, apartments, condominiums, office complexes, shopping centers, roads, railroads, port facilities, and there is not enough demand to absorb all of this new real estate development coming on to the market. And then on top of that, you have a huge demographic problem with China stemming from the overhang of its one-child policy and its toleration and indeed its encouragement of sex selection abortion. So you have a population that is going to age very rapidly, but you are building infrastructure that would be geared to a much younger and more dynamic economy. So there's this huge imbalance there that has to be worked out. And I have a clip to play on that, which I'm going to play in a minute. I just want to check chat and switchboard to see if anybody needs attention, and they do not. So a very well-known market commentator, Jim Chanos, who made market history by short-selling Enron because he did not believe all of their rosy growth projections, during the height of the Enron stock boom. He is a well-known short seller, and he's been very skeptical about China and critical about China, and believes that China is very overbought and that there are a lot of structural flaws in its economic arrangements. So I have a clip from him that I'm going to play. He appeared on CNBC, and his observations, I think, are very useful. So here we go.
Versus our shorts, so we're hedged. Having said that, some of the areas we've been negative finally seem to be working, whether it's China or energy. Those have been areas, I think, suddenly that people are getting focused on, some for the right reason, some for the wrong reason.
Do you think this correction has much more to go? I mean, what does it feel like to you?
I have no idea.
Do you think there's too much fear in the air?
Markets go up, markets go down. I mean, I have no idea where we are if this is even a correction. I mean, I think we've gotten a little complacent that it's been pretty much straight up for the last few years. That's not how markets work. But as to whether this is the start of a bear market, I have no idea, or a correction.
China is obviously getting a lot of talk. What's your best handle on what you think is really happening there? You know, the equity market was down another 4% overnight.
Yeah. It's worse than you think. Whatever you might think, it's worse. I can pretty confidently say that. We've been saying it for 5 years. I think the biggest lesson of the last 3 months, for me anyway, is that I think people are beginning to finally realize that the Chinese government is not omnipotent and omniscient. I think that that's sort of the way they've handled both the run-up in their stock market, the panic responses, the devaluation, non-devaluation, the various different mixed signals coming out of the various different ministries, I think has given investors pause that, in fact, like many of us, sometimes they don't have a clue.
Is it primarily a political issue? Is it an economic issue? Is it a toxic combination of both?
Well, the debt buildup, I mean, we've been bears because of the credit situation in China. And I think that the surprise for us of the past few years is just how the political situation has changed under Xi Jinping. He's a much different person than everybody thought he was. He's a strong leader. He's a nationalist. He's anti-Western. And so under the previous two regimes of Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, China was open for business. And that's not really the case as much under this regime. I think people are coming to grips with that.
Okay. So that was Chanos on the situation in China, and in his customary clear way, he explains that, you know, China is really trying to square the circle there. You have this authoritarian top-down government still controlled by the Communist Party, still very tightly controlled by the Communist Party, trying to operate a market economy. And there is an inherent contradiction there, because a lot of people think that in the long run, the centralization of power in China will allow the government to overcome any excesses in the market economy. But, you know, it's like oil and water. I mean, either you have a market economy or you don't. If the government becomes so powerful that dictates to the market economy what it can do, it starts to strangle the market economy and convert it into something different. Or if it lets it run amok, then the central government loses a lot of power and credibility. And in a country that has no tradition of democratic government and that has kind of very wobbly tradition of the established rule of law, that can be kind of a dangerous situation for investors, owners of private property, et cetera. So it is a very contradictory situation, and because of the huge impact China has had on the global economy, it's going to have a lot of spillover into the economies of Western Europe and the United States. Well, in addition to China, you have structural changes going on of a more normal kind. That's very obvious in information technology and telecom. Telecom is no longer enticing people as much to buy subsidized smartphones, which they pay for with pricey two-year phone contracts. You know the drill there that if you renew for 2 years, they'll upgrade your phone for a very nominal price. So you wind up paying $100 for a phone that might be $300, $400 or more. Well, Apple had a huge success with its iPhone 6, but the iPhone 6 is really priced very in a premium way. I think it's $600 to $800, and the price differential between Apple and the Android phones is getting very big, and investors are becoming concerned about the sustainability of iPhone sales because of that price differential, and because iPhone is 60% of the company. Apple is becoming less diversified because of the wild success of the iPhone, and so all of a sudden you have concerns about Apple evolving into a one-trick pony dependent on one product and the upgrade cycle that goes with it. And the risk that if the price differential between iPhone and the Android competition becomes too great, they could see a real problem with their market share and their earnings. So Apple has taken quite a hit, and of course the size of Apple in the stock indices makes that contribute to a market hit. So again, another factor roiling the market. And to kind of get an illustration of the fear, as yet, you know, it's unrealized, but there is a fear out there by investors that Apple, if it becomes too reliant on the iPhone, it could set itself up to become a BlackBerry, which is a shell of its former self. As you know, 5 years ago, BlackBerry dominated the smartphone market, but when the iPhone and Android competing phones came out with much better usability, interface, graphics, you know, the whole shebang, BlackBerry really took a nosedive, and the company has shrunk dramatically. Its stock value is a fraction of what it used to be. It's laid off tremendous numbers of people. Its market share has cratered, and there is always fear in the smartphone business that if you guess the market wrong, like BlackBerry did, a very successful company can get very unsuccessful in a very short period of time. And just another illustration of the trouble in the tech business is IBM. IBM, quarter after quarter after quarter, posts decent profit numbers but declining revenues because its business is changing as tech becomes less dependent on centralized proprietary data centers operated by corporations who are moving their operations into the cloud. The market for some of IBM's services, especially hardware and some of its software and consulting business, has been changing. So IBM is expanding into other businesses, including cloud, but the net effect of all of these changes in the tech business, IBM is declining, its revenue base is declining, and that always concerns investors because one of the big things that supports IBM's stock price is its free cash flow, and if you have a declining revenue base, free cash flow is harder to sustain. So again, these kinds of events affecting individual companies have an impact on their stock prices, and that has an impact on the overall market. Well, in markets, there's always something for investors to get jittery about, and I think a lot of the nervousness has to do not with specific news, but with the general perception of the state of the markets in 2015. The United States bull market is getting old. Corporate profits are wobbly. GDP growth is sluggish, even though there was a decent quarter that was just announced. The first quarter was very bad. It was initially reported as negative growth. They revised it to slightly positive. But when you average the two quarters together, you get kind of a mediocre 2% growth rate. And given the run-up in stocks, it's kind of hard to support values in the stock market on a 2% growth rate. So that's a problem. We've got record numbers of people out of the labor force. We have huge structural deficits. We have ever-increasing regulation on the part of the Obama administration, and they just issued a slew of new proposed regulations with respect to the environment. So there are a lot of regulatory headwinds that make people question about the sustainability of profits. Internationally, the environment is becoming increasingly unstable. You have a militarily adventurous Russia, militarily adventurous China. You have increasing instability in the Middle East. You have the whole bubbling mess with Iran. And a general perception that American power and influence are declining, and that is not good because the risk of disorder, which usually American power has had a role in lowering perceptions of that risk are now increasing. So it remains to be seen if the drip, drip, drip of worrisome economic news dies down or it intensifies into a full-blown market correction. And just for perspective, I mean, average market corrections can be 25 to 40%, and they can last for a couple of years. Now, we saw in just a few trading days the market lose 10% of its value. And I guess the thing to highlight there is that stock market corrections are not nice and spaced out and regularized. They can happen very quickly, a few weeks, bad trading weeks, and the damage is done. And similarly, on the upside, a few trading weeks, and if you're not in the market at that time, you will have risk missing a recovery in stock prices. So investors always have to, you know, make a asset allocation decision about their ability to withstand stock market losses. And, you know, my kind of guideline personally is any money that you expect to have to spend by drawing on your stock portfolio in the next 2 or 3 years, you have to be willing to risk that a correction could reduce that amount of money by 25 to 40%. And if you are uncomfortable with that, then you should be adjusting your allocations accordingly. The markets are very volatile. When they act fast, and you have to make your asset allocation decision beforehand because you cannot rely on doing it on the fly in the middle of a correction, because these corrections can be so quick that you won't have time to do it. And that rule also works when you want to get back into the market. It's very difficult to time the market. You may have to get back in long before the recovery occurs and continue to sustain some losses or zero growth, and then you ride the wave up when it happens. So lots of stuff to talk about. Okay. I want to go into just a few other things before we wrap up the show, and want to check chat and studio, make sure nobody needs attention. and nobody needs anything, so that is good. On Twitter, I am launching a Twitter hashtag called #Retro1920s, and I thought it would be very interesting, especially given the rise of importance of the current stock market. You know, we're living in a different period. 30, 40 years ago, most people in the U.S. had savings through the form of corporate pension plans, and they also had some personal savings set aside in very low-risk investments like certificates of deposit and stuff like that. In the past 30 years, because of changes in corporate America, many companies no longer offer the traditional pension plan. They offer the 401k, which means instead of a corporate pension plan guaranteed by a corporate sponsor, the primary savings vehicle in retirement for people is their 401k plan, which normally has a very heavy stock exposure. And in an era of low interest rates, many people have taken their money out of the traditional certificates of deposit and money market mutual funds, and they've put their non-pension savings into more risky vehicles. So one of the things I want to do with the Retro 1920s hashtag is to give a little perspective on, you know, one of the legendary bull markets of the time. The 1920s was a period where capitalism seemed to have unchallenged ascendancy. And then, of course, it came to an end for various reasons at the end of the decade, starting with the crash, but not because of the crash of 1929. A lot of what happened during the Depression was not a result of the Black Friday event of 1929, but it was it really had to do with government reaction to the economic situation in 1930 and 1931. The governments of the day made many missteps, which exacerbated the Depression and made everything worse. So I will be covering that in my Twitter hashtag retrospective. And I tweeted one thing out a few days ago just to show the buoyancy of the stock market in 1929. Back in the day, a stock pool centered around one company were like the equivalent of the hedge funds of today. And one stock pool, RCA, was able to push the stock of RCA from the mid-20s in 1926 to $400 by 1929. So there was a tremendous amount of speculation in the marketplace. And the thing to be remembered about the 1920s market is how much money you lost was really a function of when you got into the market. If you were never in the stock market at all, but put all of your money into the top back in September of 1929, it would have taken you 25 years up to 1954 to break even. But if you had invested a few years later, your break-even period, a few years earlier, I should say, your break-even period would have been much less. So that kind of illustrates the danger of market timing. You have to have a consistent investment strategy tailored to your personal situation and avoid the temptation to try to time the markets with massive reallocations of your wealth. Unless you're so wealthy, it really doesn't make any difference. Okay, going to the political scene. Just a few things to note, and then we'll wrap up for the day. Seems to be a low comment day in terms of chat and the switchboard, as opposed to the show I did on the debate, which was a high comment day. We had a terrible tragedy. We had two, actually, the past week. The Virginia television studio shootings, and then the terrible assassination of the police officer in Houston, who was assassinated when he was trying to refuel his car. He wasn't even killed in the line of duty, as defined as trying to apprehend a criminal. He was just there doing a very routine thing, refueling his car, and somebody came out and shot and killed him. With the Virginia shootings, when that occurred, there was an incredible and extremely distasteful outburst of opportunism on the part of the liberal media, who immediately, within 30, 40 minutes of the shooting, started to beat the drum for gun control. But then all of a sudden, when the identity of this shooter, who worked for the same television studio and whose television name was Bryce Williams, when it became known that he was a liberal activist, an Obama supporter, a very person very alienated by racial matters, that he had constantly made false accusations of racial prejudice at work, that he was fired, that he was just being swept up into the whole race war phenomenon, all of a sudden the Twitter sphere became silent. The initial push by Governor McAuliffe and Hillary Clinton saying this is just a perfect illustration of why we need gun control, all of a sudden it got very muted. And this is one of the really awful things about our contemporary society, is the tendency of the left to exploit tragedy in pursuit of their political agenda before the bodies are even cold. And I'm hoping that this gets a lot more coverage during the debates on the role of the media in our society and the role of leftist activist groups in our society as we have the presidential debate season unfold, especially on the Republican side, where, you know, Donald Trump and to a lesser extent Ted Cruz and in their own way Scott Walker, Ben Carson, are taking pot shots at the establishment consensus. In the presidential race, we've got the phenomenon of Bernie and Biden and Jeb and Joe. Bernie Sanders continues to do well because people are becoming very distrustful of Hillary Clinton. This email scandal of hers illustrates just how alienated she is from the expectations of normal Americans who expect their elected representatives to comply with the law. And now Hillary is embroiled in these complex interpretations of the law and what was classified and when it was classified. Regardless of the outcome of that legal analysis, the scandals have been very damaging to Hillary because the bottom line is, what the hell was she thinking about with a private server over which she knew sensitive government information, including classified information, was going to come? And the whole episode reminds people about her worst qualities, her deviousness, her secretiveness, her tendency to hide behind legalese, her sense of entitlement, her shrill non-answers when she's attacked. Plus, it also focuses on the foreign policy that she implemented, which is in disrepute. The ambassador to Libya is still dead. We have unrest and disorder escalating in Libya, in Syria, all over the Middle East because of the Obama-Clinton moves in foreign policy from 2009 to 2012. Joe Biden is kind of interesting because he seems to be being pushed into the race by the Obama people, who clearly have not buried the hatchet with Hillary. There is a lot of distrust between the Obamas and the Clintons. It goes back to the 2008 campaign and earlier. It goes back to the Obama people's perception that Clinton was too much of a centrist, that both Clintons were too much of a too centrist, that they were too inclined to compromise, that they can't be entrusted with his vision of transforming American society, even though Hillary is bending over backwards to embrace every leftist move that Obama has ever made. The Obamas don't trust them because I think they fear that if the 2016 election results in a Democratic president and again a Republican Congress, the Clintons will compromise just like they did in the 90s with a Republican Congress. So they are trying to undermine her by pushing the Biden candidacy. And I have to say, I mean, I just think, following the suggestion by Dick Morris, that this constant drip, drip, drip of anti-Hillary news from the Justice Department regarding the email scandal would not be happening if the president were really behind a Hillary candidacy, or at least was neutral towards a Hillary candidacy. I don't think he is neutral. I think he is hostile. And that leaves us with Jeb. Jeb Bush is attracting a lot of attention, all for the wrong reasons. I mean, his fundraising seems to be wobbling a little bit. Some of his fundraisers are jumping ship. He is drawing a lot of criticism, which started during the August debate and is continuing, about just a lack of momentum and drive in his candidacy and a tendency to put his foot in his mouth. I mean, everybody knew that Donald Trump was going to be controversial with some of his statements, but everybody expected Jeb to be just the height of respectable rhetoric. And he's gotten caught out in this immigration debate. He took a slam at Asian women, accusing them of abusing the anchor baby system as opposed to Hispanics. And that, to me, was a very clueless remark. I mean, he should not be ethnicizing the whole anchor baby thing. It should be a legal analysis, not it's okay if one group does it, but not if another group does it. Of course, he caught some flack for using the term anchor babies. In my opinion, using the term anchor babies is totally acceptable because that colorfully describes the reality of the situation. I see a guest in chat. Just want to welcome them. The show is going to wrap up in a few minutes. If anybody wants to call into the show, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. Jeb Bush continues to unimpress, and what's going on in the political arena is that you've got the continued ascendancy of Donald Trump, who continues to hold a commanding lead in the polls, even though a lot of the Republican establishment, including a lot of the established conservative media, do not like him for different reasons, and they continue to criticize him for very contradictory reasons. I mean, I've read so many things on Twitter where they're simultaneously going after him for being too close to Democrats and also being an extremist demagogue, and I'm like, it can't be both. But the guy obviously does have a lot of people who are very antagonistic towards him for one reason or another, but the general public continues to buy into the message, and his numbers are going up across most demographics. The other kind of big winner this week is Ben Carson, who has rising in the polls in Iowa, who's attracting a lot of, I would say, favorable attention because of that sort of steady, stately demeanor that he has. Very reasonable guy, very antithesis of Obama, and of course coming from the medical profession and with the ongoing debate about the terrible thing with the baby part sales by Planned Parenthood, Ben Carson has the potential of speaking very powerfully to the moral disintegration that seems to be characteristic of a lot of American society. So I think we're going to see him ascend for a while because I think that the medical controversies have really helped him by focusing attention on the life ethic, which is a big part of this election cycle. The last thing I want to cover, which I think is very interesting, very nuts and bolts, bread and butter issue, is the looming financial implications out there of both Obamacare and Medicare. 2016 is the year in which almost the full implementation of Obamacare is going to be felt, including the taxes that are going to be incurred by some of the better, the higher benefit corporate medical benefit plans. And these companies are going to be under pressure to pass along some of or all of the tax increases they are going to be hit with to their employees. 2016 is also the year in which the penalty for not having health insurance is going to rise to 2.5% of your income. It started out with 1%, then it doubled to 2% in 2015, and then it will go to 2.5% in 2016. So if you are uninsured and you are earning a decent amount of money, not necessarily rich by any means, but if you're in the $60,000-$70,000 bracket, $60,000-$70,000 income level, the toll you are going to have to pay for not having an Obamacare compliant plan will go to 2.5%, which is not a small amount of money. And then lastly, the government announced that there was going to be no cost of living increase for Social Security beneficiaries in 2016. And because Social Security is very linked to Medicare, that has a chain reaction, because if there is no Social Security, as I understand it, and I'm still reading up on this, if there is no Social Security benefit increase, Medicare cannot raise Medicare premiums for the less affluent Medicare beneficiaries, but they can raise Medicare premiums for the more affluent Medicare beneficiaries to compensate for the premiums that they cannot assess, the increased premiums they cannot assess on the less affluent Medicare beneficiaries. And the net effect of that is going to be potentially a 50% increase in Medicare Part B premiums for the more affluent half, if you will, of the Medicare beneficiary population. And I have a feeling that the Obama people are really scratching their heads trying to come up with a way around that, because that's going to hit in an election year. So the ongoing rollout of the Obama Medicare policies and Obamacare tax increases and Obamacare benefit impairment is going to continue into the 2016 election season, and it is going to do that in a very publicized way. So that's kind of the wrap-up of the my take on the markets and some of the political news for this past week. If you are listening to this show in archive, I want to thank you for dropping in. Our future plans, I'm going to try to do a show every Sunday, maybe bi-monthly. It seems to be a good schedule for doing shows. And we will have a show on the debate night. The timing of it depends on if I can get a live audio feed. I'll broadcast the debate during the show. If I can't get a live audio feed through the internet, what I'll do is I'll open up the chat during the debate for people who want to participate in a chat instead of yelling at their television set. And then post-debate, we'll do a brief hour show where people can vent their reactions to the candidates. And just as important these days, the moderators. So for any of my listeners, I again want to thank you for dropping in. And as far as the presidential season is concerned, I can't emphasize this enough. Whether you like Trump or not, do not like Trump, whether you like another candidate or you don't like another candidate, just feel free to express your convictions regardless of the numerous people out there in the Twitter sphere and in social media who will criticize your choices and jump on you and you know, call you bigoted and prejudiced and all sorts of names if you support a choice that they don't like. It's your right to support whom you want, to defend them in public, and not to let people try to emotionally blackmail you into repressing your views with false accusations that you're a person of ill will and you have bad intentions or whatever. Just don't pay them attention. Follow your conscience. Support the candidate that you think is best for the country and run with it. And on that note, I'll close with my official campaign theme of 2015. Good night. Have a great day. Well, it doesn't seem to be playing. So I'll try one more, and if not, we'll just close without a clip. Okay, they're not playing. Block Talk has been having a lot of problems with clips, so I apologize for that. They've been upgrading their studio to accommodate high-fidelity sound, and then the whole enterprise seems to have imploded. And as a result, whether a host put hi-fi clips or not hi-fi clips, a lot of their clips have become unplayable. So I apologize for that. I'll reload the clips for next show. And again, once again, thank you for listening and have a great day. Bye-bye.